This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. It's very easy to study the history of the British Empire from the perspective of, well, the British. And to extend the early 20th century version of the empire as a world-spanning entity backwards throughout history. But David Vevers, in his new book, The Great Defiance, How the World Took on the British Empire, studies the English and later British empires from a different perspective. Not the British, but the Irish, Native Americans, Southeast Asians, Indians that the British met, traded, and often fought with. And he shows that, for much of its history, the British Empire's position was far more precarious than its later dominance implies. Dr. David Vevers is an award-winning historian and lectured early modern history at the University of Bangor and was formerly a Leverhulme Fellow in the School of History at Queen Mary University of London. His acclaimed academic book, The Origins of the British Empire in Asia, 1600 to 1750, was published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. Today, Dave and I talked about how the English Empire got its start and how other groups pushed back. So, David, thanks for coming on the show today to talk about the Great Defiance. And I guess I want to start by asking kind of what prompted you to kind of give the book this title? What's missing from our understanding of the history of the British Empire that drove you to write this book?
Yeah, I think predominantly much of the writing on certainly the earlier days of the British Empire are very much on, why did the English, leave their sort of slightly impoverished drab island on the northwest coast of Europe and strike out across the Atlantic and down into the Mediterranean, down to the west coast of Africa and round the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean, what drove them to do it. Then a lot of sculptures, the how did they do it? And that's a kind of more pervasive question on European colonialism more broadly. How did these rather small, demographically, certainly on a kind of smaller scale, comparatively to places like Asia and so forth, how did they manage to overwhelm and conquer so much of the world? So that's, predominantly a kind of creates a narrative of the kind of rise, almost like the inevitable success. And part of that comes from, we know what's going to happen by the 19th century. We know countries like Great Britain, like France. We know countries like, Spain and Portugal and so forth do conquer large swathes of the world. But that sort of theological thinking and sort of the understanding that the period we're looking at whilst knowing what's going to happen, sort of, I think for me, kind of creates a sort of inevitability. This idea of sort of stripping the present of its complexity and sort of crowbarring it into this narrative of the success of Europeans. And so much of the historiography and much of the scholarship we have on the British Empire and its expansion, it comes from that place of success and seeing how they managed to assemble this rather large empire. What I wanted to do is see that actually that process takes almost 300 years. There's a 300-year history of the Anglo-British Empire before before Queen Victoria comes to the throne. Much of the, you know, if you go to a bookshop and a popular bookshop, you browse the section, if you're lucky enough to have one, on the British Empire or European colonialism or world history, as it's often known. Much of it's from the sort of 19th century, 20th century. But yeah, so I wanted to kind of shed light on this earlier 300 year history in which the English and into the 18th century, the British are really actually quite struggling to assert themselves and to dominate the people and the states and societies that they encounter. And actually, the defining narrative is not European success or conquest. There's very little inevitability when you look at it from the point of the late 16th century or the early 17th century. Actually, in some cases, all the way into the late 18th century. In fact, the defining storytelling account, the defining analytical lens for understanding this is actually the remarkable resilience of these indigenous and non-European societies, the wealth of the economies, the success of the economies, the kind of dynamism, the resilience of their political structures, and the appeal and the success of their cultural systems. And so when we kind of write these off as the inevitable victims of European or English colonialism, we kind of pave over that. And we see them almost naturally as failed states because they couldn't ultimately withstand European conquest. But I think when we place that in its earlier chronological context, and we're talking about 300 years, you know, that's not failure. That's not weak states or cultures usually overwhelmed. And so, my academic work looks at the sort of resilience, the ability of Southeast Asian states to have sort of almost absorbed Europeans in that first wave of colonialism, and for Europeans to have to sort of work in within the structures of power and economic. An economic influence and wealth. And so I thought, well, what does that look like outside of Southeast Asia? You know, Southeast Asia and the Indian subcontinent is home to some of the world's largest powers in the early modern period. And so I thought, well, let's take this understanding that the Europeans don't necessarily immediately succeed in what they're aiming to do. What does that look like in the Mediterranean and the west coast of Africa? What does that look like in the Atlantic? And so, I started to quickly uncover stories of remarkable success in resisting English designs, whether that was to achieve monopolies on commercial goods or to displace people from the land and settle it with colonists, or to subdue political systems into vassals or puppets. In what other way, however the English attempted to expand themselves, they were resisted almost everywhere they went, from Ireland to the Caribbean, North America, in the Mediterranean and West Africa, and into the Indian Ocean. And some of this resistance took place, it was intergenerational, some cases over centuries of time before the English finally achieved the sort of hegemony that they sought from the very beginning. So I thought that this is the defining narrative for me. It's almost, in fact, it is as important as the English eventually succeeding by the 19th century, this idea of the way in which the English left their island home to achieve these monopolies and to settle these lands and to acquire these resources, and they were defied at almost every turn. So I wanted to take this from the rise of Europeans to this kind of the defiance of Europeans, which for me was a far more interesting story and one that we haven't seen too much for the British Empire.
Well, the important thing is that for a lot of the book, it's not actually the British Empire, it's the English Empire. And so I wanted to ask kind of like, what exactly is England and the, I guess, the quote-unquote English Empire during this time? You know, what place does England hold in the international system of the day? Or maybe even in the European system of the day?
I think it's a good question, because really, if you want to talk the kind of the league tables of early modern powers, England is very much at the bottom, almost everywhere. Within Europe, it's really the weaker power. It spends much of the later 16th century grappling against the overwhelming power of Spain, which at this point has already assembled a global empire, especially in the Americas. It can't even compete against the Netherlands, really, by the early 17th century. The Netherlands, a very small collection of Dutch provinces and states, demographically speaking, geographically, they look like they could be the junior competitor to England. But in fact, they're not. So England has, you know, it's for much of this period, all the way through to the 19th century, even into the Industrial Revolution, England's main export is woolen goods and textiles, manufactured textiles eventually. It's not a great economic powerhouse. I mean, this is one of the things that drives the English overseas at the beginning of this period of empire, because they're looking to access the wealth that the Spanish and the Portuguese and then latterly the Dutch have managed to do overseas. And so it's partly the poverty of the English that that seek them to acquire an empire. And so within Europe itself, it's very much riding the coattails of other European powers and hoping to, you know, if you look at a country like Portugal or even Spain, it's sparsely inhabited at the end of the 15th century. Economically, mostly overwhelmingly agriculture. But within a century later, by the end of the 16th century, Portugal's monopoly over the spice trade in Asia, you know, Spanish control of silver mines in South America, these have transformed these rather kind of insignificant countries into global powerhouses of economic and military influence. And so this is very much what England is looking to ape. It's looking to replicate this success. And so, you know, it literally consumes Spanish and Portuguese accounts of the New World, I'm putting that in bracket, in quote marks there, and it mimics the Dutch route around the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean, looking for spices and sumptuous Indian cotton textiles and luxurious Japanese and Chinese silk. And so just within Europe, it's, yeah, I know England is quite an unremarkable country, very much at the bottom. But then globally, it becomes even more insignificant when you put England against the likes of the Mughal Empire in India. Which at this point, you know, perhaps has a population of 125 million people. The North Gangetic Plain in India is some of the most kind of productive and fertile territory anywhere in the world. You know, it's armies of 100, 200,000 soldiers. The conquest of the Mughal emperors, you know, they're conquering kingdoms and states the size of Western Europe. You know, even when England gets to a place like Java, the island of Java, today's Indonesia, and it goes to the pepper port of Banten, which is really the primary export region for pepper. Roughly half of the pepper of Asia goes through Banten. It can't even compete against the commercial groups it finds in. You know, the English rock up with woolen, predominantly woolen goods, tin, some iron. No one really wants that. In the tropical climes of Southeast Asia, they're dressed in Indian cotton or Chinese silk. They don't want English woolly jumpers. And so the English have very little to offer. They can't compete. And actually, they're kind of mocked by the Chinese and the Javanese, who are far more successful commercial groups, able to supply markets with the goods that are in demand, able to forge the partnerships that allow their merchants to succeed. The English lack the knowledge, they lack the experience, and they lack the sort of kind of commercial acumen necessary to establish themselves. So it's almost anywhere in the world, within Europe itself or outside, the English and its kind of, you know, budding empire is kind of really something almost to be mocked. At that very stage, as England kind of sets its sights in North America and to compete in the Indian Ocean, you know, it's still struggling to conquer its nearest neighbour, Ireland. And the conquest of Ireland really goes back to the Norman period. It's been going on for about 600 years, and there was a sort of a collapse of English control in the 15th century. And by the beginning of the 16th century, the English attempt to reconquer Ireland, and it's a long, bitter 100-year struggle. And so when Queen Elizabeth sort of launches the East India Company, and when the Virginia Company is launched under her successor, England is still struggling. It's still unable really to subdue the Irish lords. And so that, for a lot of people, you know, that's the measure of English power when it sets out to start its overseas empire, is that it doesn't seem to be faring too well even in its own backyard.
You know, we talk about a lot of these kind of early attempts at empire in Ireland and North America and the Caribbean. They all seem very expensive. They don't seem to be very successful. Colonies get wiped out and then more people are sent. Everyone's trying to raise money by promising huge riches, and then they don't find them. How did these endeavors get funded?
Yes, I mean, it's a good question. It's a question that was on the mind of policymakers and the crown and certain interests that undertook some of these colonial projects. I mean, so you really see kind of a period, certainly in the late 16th and into the 17th century, of experiment. You know, how do we do this? How do we break into the Portuguese monopoly over spice? It's a monopoly that's violently upheld by overwhelming naval power and a string of mighty fortresses. And, you know, how do we compete with the Dutch? The Dutch financial centres of Amsterdam and its markets of Antwerp are some of the most lucrative in the world. And, you know, when the Dutch launched their East India Company at the beginning of the 17th century, you know, their liquid capital is enormous. It's, you know, it's in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds. At the time, England can only acquire something like £60,000 to launch its own East India Company. So it's a very small commercial endeavour compared to its rivals. So there's sort of a mixture of crown intervention, especially in its first colony in Ireland. The crown attempts to, when the Tudors come to the throne at the end of the 15th century, all the way through to the end of the 16th century, the crown sort of advances and retreats, depending on the resources it's able to acquire. And it has to rely more or less on proxies, on powerful Irish lords that exercise power on the crown's behalf. And that relieves the crown of the burden of financing campaigns in Ireland to crush rebellion and to conquer independent lords. But obviously it also gives the Irish lords in control a fair degree of independence to do what they want. It's only by the Elizabethan period that the crown is able to sort of step back and think, well, this isn't working. You know, we don't have the resources to finance large-scale settlement. We don't have the resources to campaign against Irish enemies. There's one rebellion. It's known as we can call it a rebellion, we call it uprising, we can call it a war. But the Irish Anglo-Irish lords of Southwest Ireland, region known as Munster, essentially rebel, and the war costs Elizabeth something like £250,000, which is a substantial amount of money for the cash-strapped Elizabethan monarchy. And it convinces Elizabeth that she just doesn't have the money to do this. And so the same in the Mediterranean. In the Mediterranean is the lucrative trade of the Ottoman Empire, of the Italian city-states. There's access to all sorts of goods coming overland through Central Asia and also through the maritime corridors from Southeast Asia, and in specifically silks and spices and enslaved people. And you know, this is the place to be. And the English try and crack this from the mid-16th century onwards. But by the 1580s, Elizabeth can't even afford to underwrite the cost of a permanent embassy in Constantinople. There's just not the money for it. And so these sort of colonial initiatives often are very limited or often fail early on because of a lack of resourcing. And so you get this period of experiment at the end of the 16th and into the 17th century of what some historians have kind of called almost outsourcing empire, of essentially turning to private citizens to partnership with the crown and to help finance and underwrite the costs of English expansion overseas. And so what we get at the end of the 16th and into the early 17th century is a plethora of corporations emerging who are chartered by the crown, have the royal authority of the crown, in some respects quite a degree of autonomy to exercise royal power, and in exchange they provide the money, and they invest and pull together the ships, the capital, and the necessary manpower to colonize Virginia, the Virginia Company, in Massachusetts, to crack the Russian market, the Muscovy Company, most importantly the Levant Company, which is to maintain a monopoly over trade in the Eastern Mediterranean with the all-powerful Ottoman Empire. And of course, perhaps most infamously for its later success, the East India Company, in which 215 aldermen, merchants and noblemen come together and acquire a charter from Elizabeth She tasked them with essentially serving national interests by exporting English manufacturers to the markets in Asia, by not taking out any more than £10,000 a year worth of silver. Didn't want to drain the wealth of the country, and also to establish diplomatic relations on her behalf with Asian rulers. And so it has to serve the national interest in a way, but essentially then that allows these corporations to essentially control and benefit from the trade and from settlement in these regions. And you know, a lot of these consortiums, these corporations have deep, deep pockets. They're in a way mimicking what's going on in the Netherlands with the establishment of permanent joint stock corporations. These are the forerunners of our modern corporations today, like Apple, Amazon, and BP and so forth. And these are the entities in a majority of England's early focus of colonialism and empire that are undertaking expansion on the Crown's behalf. Now, in the context of what I would argue about in my book, not many of them succeed. And we see it across the 17th century, a rather spectacular collapse of many of these corporate entities, because even with their deep pockets and their private capital, with the state backing, they just no match for the indigenous and powers that they encounter. And so obviously the corporations have to turn a profit. Colonial or empire building is not always profitable. And so that often leads to the collapse. Most spectacularly, the Virginia Company in 1622, with the massacre of its colonists, essentially is liquidated. We see that all the way into the 18th century. The Royal African Company, which has a monopoly over the trade in enslaved people from West Africa to the colonies in the Caribbean, because of the expansion of the Kingdom of Dahomey, West African Kingdom, which drives the price of enslaved people up and forces the company to adhere to royal monopolies, eventually leads to its implosion as well.
I am unfortunately going to skip over deeper questions on Ireland and North America and the Caribbean, because I and while they're important, because I do want to pivot to talking about Asia and the early English efforts to break into Southeast and Southeast Asia. Mm. You know, how successful, or perhaps more accurately unsuccessful, are these early efforts to kind of get a foothold in this region?
It's funny because with, you know, perhaps you don't need to know a lot about the history of England or Britain's empire to know or be familiar with the East India Company. You know, even in popular culture, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, on our TV screens more recently, and in more forms of kind of popular history writing, the East India Company looms large because it's an example of the most successful a corporate initiative of England that that eventually, as we know, ends up conquering the entire Indian subcontinent and large slices of the rest of South and Southeast Asia. But again, as I said earlier on in the talk, that's 250 years later after its founding. And so what we don't often do is question the East India Company's success, because it looks so successful from the advantage of a quarter of a millennium later. But actually, for much of its earlier history, the East India Company is not just unsuccessful, but on numerous occasions, it almost implodes. And so it's a really checkered, certainly that first 100-year history in the 17th century. The East India Company is launched on New Year's Eve in 1600, as I said earlier, by 215 private citizens, a mixture of all city aldermen, nobles and high-flying bankers and financiers. And their remit is to break into the spice trade in Southeast Asia, as the Portuguese and the Dutch have. You know, we all have that cupboard of spices that perhaps we don't regularly use, but we like to think, you know, we've got our cardamom there, we've got our paprika. But actually, once upon a time, in the early modern period, that cupboard of spice would have been worth its weight in gold. Spices, to a certain extent, drove the early modern global economy. Access to spices had the actual, you know, the real effect of perhaps transforming your country economically into a kind of first-rate economic power, as it had the Portuguese, as it was doing to the Dutch. And so the East India Company's remit was really to establish a foothold in the spice trade. That doesn't go well. As I said earlier, the English don't really offer anything that the people in Java, the Chinese merchants, those from Malacca and from South India, all of whom are crowding into Banten, which is the primary port for spices, and especially for pepper. And the English, they're really kind of, they're good spoil in the heat. Diplomatically, they have no success in forging a kind of working relationship with the king and his regents. Two successive kings of Banten in the first half of the 17th century are essentially adolescents, and the port is ruled by a regency. And the English get very frustrated at this, mostly because, you know, not only can they not compete with the Asian merchants, but also with the Dutch, who are always kind of breathing down their neck. The Dutch are better financed, they're better resourced, they've got more military muscle. And, you know, they're brawling in the streets, essentially. So it doesn't go well. And within the first decade at the Port of Banten, England is getting ready to withdraw from the spice trade altogether. And they eventually, the frustration with the region of the port leads the English to start attacking Chinese ships in the harbour of Banten. And so the regent retaliates by expelling the English from the port altogether. And actually, rather humiliatingly, the English have to move in with the Dutch in Jakarta, further up the coast, because they've now got no base in Indonesia. Part of this has come about because the English and the Dutch start to fight, and there's a number of naval conflicts in which the English come off worse. And after a few years of fighting the Dutch East India Company, the only thing that prevents the East India Company's complete destruction is that James I, the King of England, eventually negotiates with the Dutch states and comes to an agreement where it's essentially the Dutch East India Company absorbs the English East India Company. We often think of it as a merger. The English have to abandon their forts and factories and move into Dutch forts and factories, pay the costs or upkeep of those forts and factories, and in exchange they get a much smaller slice of the spice trade than the Dutch, but they get a guaranteed access to spices. And the Dutch take something like 75% and the English 25%. So it's a rather humiliating first 20 years to the East India Company's existence. It's not a big success. And the same is elsewhere. One of the things they think is going to save them is they tap into Japan. Japan is a relatively unknown quantity for the English. There have been accounts circulated in Europe by the Portuguese and more latterly by the Dutch themselves, who established themselves in 1609. And the English, all they know is that Japan is abundant in silver. It's a very rugged, very mountainous country, of course, and it's abundant in mineral resources, mostly silver. So it's a silver-heavy economy, and that really is the kind of solution to the East India Company's problem. It's having to pay for everything in cash from England, because no one wants their goods. And it thinks if it can tap into the trade in Japan, exchange goods for silver, use Japanese silver to then purchase spices and Indian textiles and Chinese silk. And so it's seen as kind of the great solution to all of the company's problems. But unfortunately, Japan is a far tougher nut to crack than anywhere else, really. Mostly because the sort of reports that the English are going into Japan, the sort of reports they've read and the accounts that they've consumed in Europe from the Portuguese and the Dutch, are kind of outdated by about 30 or 40 years. And when the English arrive in 1613, Japan is a very different place than it was even 10, 15 years ago. In that period, the Sengoku period, it's very much a warring states period in which the local daimyos or lords fight for power. And it has been going on for 150 years. Now, in the subsequent period, in 1600, a clan, the Tokugawa clan, leads the Eastern coalition against the Western daimyos, defeats them overwhelmingly, and unites Japan the first time in 150 years and succeeds in establishing a stable shogunate. Ayusa becomes the shogun and essentially creates a very centralized, highly regulated state, one that's capable of controlling trade, conducting global diplomacy, regulating its borders. It's a radical departure from, as I said, just decades ago. And so the English are very much coming and thinking it's the local daimyo lords that you have to get in with to access trade and political influence. And it's those that you need to spend your gifts on. And it's in those local regions, in those provinces and outlying regions, where you have to establish your factories and your ports. For them, you know, Edo, Kyoto, these were still centres that had lost their power over the past 150 years. Of course, that's all changed now. And so when the English establish themselves in Japan, they do it at Harada. Harada is a small sort of fishing hamlet about 1,000 kilometres from Edo, the capital where the shogun resides. The shogun succeeded in setting up a highly regulated trading system, the Red Seal system, where you have to essentially acquire a license from the shogun and his bakufu officials in Edo if you want to trade anywhere in Japan and between Japan and elsewhere. And the English, they don't have the resources to launch expensive annual embassies to Edo to pour money on the shogun and his officials to acquire these licenses. And so within about 10 or 15 years, the English East India Company factory is essentially bankrupt and has to be shut down. That partly, but also it's the power of the Tokugawa shogunate and its centralization of power leaves little room for Europeans to exploit the riches of Japan as they had previously. When Japan was essentially at civil war, the Portuguese had success in spreading Catholicism, in monopolizing trade. That's not possible by the 17th century. And succeeding shoguns ban Christianity and massacre Christian converts. They limit the trading privileges of the Portuguese, the Dutch, and the English. And by 1623, the English are confined to Harada and they can't travel elsewhere in Japan. So they eventually withdraw the factory, but just 10 years later, all Europeans except the Dutch are eventually expelled. So unless you were powerful, had the resources and the political capital to break in to places like Japan, it was just too difficult for the East India Company. And that's one side of it. The other side of it, of course, is that, you know, the Japanese had succeeded in establishing, you know, a highly regulated, very powerfully centralized, militarized state that that was able to push the English and other Europeans to the margins without suffering the sort of colonial conquest which much of Asia does in the next few centuries, but Japan manages to successfully avoid.
You know, I do want to ask quickly about one historical figure that pops up in this part of the book, which is William Adams, who I know through a fictionalized version in the 2017 video game Neo, but is perhaps more famous now as the basis for the fictional character in the Shogun TV show, which is just out now. So quickly, just like who was William Adams and how does he figure into this historical period?
Well, he's a really fascinating, you know, I'm always surprised that he hasn't been fictionalized more, or we don't see him more often in you know, any kind of form of popular culture. Is a really fascinating example of the proliferation of I mean, I guess you could call them cosmopolitan figures. We see the early modern period as being quite rigidly sort of people living quite static lives and nations warring and living rather parochial lives. But actually, you know, he's a great example of someone who crossed many borders and lived many different lives to his own advantage. So William Adams, He lived near Chatham in Kent, just by the Royal Dockyards. And so he sort of grew up watching ships come and go. And he was always desperate, almost from an early age, to join those ships and to kind of strike out overseas. And he has a family. He grows up, he becomes an apprentice in London, I think. And he has a wife and small children. But he eventually joins the North African Company, or the Barbary Company, as it's known, an English company that traded to Morocco for sugar, which is not what we usually think of trade. You usually think sugar in the Caribbean from slave plantations. But the English attempt to crack into this in the 1580s, Moroccan sugar is just too expensive, and it's a bit of a failure. And rather than come home, though, he becomes he's signed up by the Dutch East India Company when it launches in 1599. and he becomes a pilot for Dutch ships in the East India Company. The Dutch are trying to access Japan. They've been trying to go around the Cape of Good Hope and challenge the Portuguese in over the spice trade. But they're always looking for vulnerabilities in the Portuguese Empire. And one of the ways they try and crack into that is by going the other way through the Straits of Magellan and popping up in the Pacific. And like the English, they've been consuming accounts of Japan and Japanese riches, and they know that much of Portuguese wealth, we think of the spice trade, but actually a lot of it is its control of the trade route between Macau in China and Nagasaki in Japan. That's about the export of raw Chinese silk, which the Japanese were desperate for, and in exchange for silver, which the silver-starved Chinese economy was desperate for, and some other goods, Japanese swords and metal work and lacquerware and so forth. But it's a very enormously rich trade route. The Portuguese annually make from that trade route about the same as the entire capital of the Dutch East India Company. So the Dutch cross, they hire William Adams, and they take a small fleet of ships, which he pilots through the straits, and it's treacherous. They get trapped in the ice. Most of them die. They stop in South America when they eventually emerge from the straits, and they to refuel and reprovision, and most of the crew are killed by indigenous people. And eventually, one ship survives. That's William Adams' ship. And they sort of almost drift across the Pacific and land in Kyushu. Not so much land as bump into Kyushu. There's only really about five men still on their feet. Everyone else has either died or are too weak to stand. William Adams is one of those five people. And at Kyushu, the southern island of Japan, they're met by the local daimyo and his soldiers, and they're initially detained and imprisoned because the Portuguese are so influential in Japan. They've managed to essentially convince the Japanese that Portugal is Europe and Europe is Portugal. And so one of the first things the Portuguese do when they find out of the arrival of this Dutch fleet with this English pilot, of course all being Protestant, is they're worried that the Shogun might learn that there's a kind of schism between Catholics and Protestants in Europe, and that essentially there are other European nations that are trying to challenge Portuguese power. And so that has the ability to sort of shatter the Portuguese image that it's projected in Japan as essentially Portugal being Europe and the Catholic faith being the overwhelming belief of much of the world. And so this idea of a sort of infighting Europe of warring states whose faith has splintered into different sects is potentially enormously exciting. The Shogun finds out, and he very much enjoys himself discovering that the Portuguese are actually just one of a number of small states in far-off Europe. And so the Shogun, Ayasu Tokugawa, invites William Adams up to Edo and employs him as a shipwright for designing and replicating Spanish galleons up to 800 tons, capable, and this is a really important point, of crossing the Pacific Ocean. And he does. William Adams does that, and he's rewarded by becoming Hatamoto, a Japanese junior lord. But he acquires an estate of 100 families, and he essentially has a Japanese wife and family. And he's very much kind of assimilating Japanese society, still partly working for the Dutch company. The Dutch, through his mediation, established themselves in 1609, and he acts as the kind of broker of the Dutch factory, and with the Portuguese and eventually the Spanish. And so essentially he's the kind of the broker of European trade. And so his value of the Shogun as a shipwright, but he's also valuable for bringing in European goods and trade. And he becomes an enormously influential figure with Ayasu Tokugawa, not so much with his son Hidehada, who distrusts all Europeans. William Adams oversees the construction of these ocean-going vessels that the Shogun sends across the Pacific. Now, one of them lands with a Japanese ambassador at Acapulco, which is in New Mexico, and the Spanish authorities are absolutely flabbergasted, completely freaked out that the Japanese have managed to kind of essentially cross what they see as their preserve, the Pacific, and are coming to South America to trade and establish themselves. And so they impound, they confiscate the Japanese ship and impound it, completely traumatized that it looks exactly like one of their own ships. And it's just a great example that, you know, we often think of Japan as an inward-looking country. You know, it eventually will seal its borders, more or less. And we have this narrative that it's the Americans in the 19th century that come and open Japan up. But no, very much Japan is an outward-looking country for many centuries before then. They eventually send another ambassador on one of these ocean-going vessels that has more success, and he ends up traveling around America, going on to Europe, meeting Philip II, and being baptized by the Pope. And there's if you go to Pope and Vatican City today, and you look up at St. Paul's, there's a mural of this Japanese ambassador, very, very small, right up in the corner. It's a pretty wonderful thing to see. Anyway, so William Adams has a successful career, but his patron Ayusa dies eventually, and his son is less pleased. And William Adams essentially loses all of his influence and access at court, and he dies in 1620, shortly before the English then lose their one connection to court. When the English arrive, they employ William Adams as their broker, and he has the only success the English have in Japan is through William Adams, and he allows them to launch a couple of trade voyages from Japan to elsewhere in Southeast Asia. It has mixed success. But that with that connection severed, the English essentially then end up packing it in because of that lost connection. So he's kind of a really interesting, like, cultural chameleon, able to cross these different borders, be employed by these different nations and corporations, and he makes a very successful life for himself. So he's a really interesting figure, and one I still don't think there's been even enough research done on.
So kind of at this point in your book, there's a pretty big transition, which is the English Empire becomes the British Empire after the Act of Union. How does the Act of Union change the character of now British Empire?
Yes, I think I think it does quite dramatic ways. I think there's still some continuities we don't stress enough, but essentially, you know, the English Empire that I've been describing is essentially being driven by the English state, which in the 16th and 17th century is kind of a weak, fiscally, military speaking. It's politically unstable. There's a civil war. The king gets his head chopped off. It's unstable all the way down till the end of the 17th century, the Glorious Revolution. The king is replaced by a Dutch prince. It's kind of riven by religious strife, and yeah, so it's a thoroughly kind of unstable politically, religiously, fiscally and militarily. It's weak, you know, right until the 1660s, 1670s. You know, the English are fighting the Dutch, and the Dutch fleet, the English king essentially goes bankrupt, docks the fleet, and the Dutch sail up the Medway right into the heart of England and burns the ship and captures it. You know, it's just such a it's a rather weak political entity, and it struggles to project itself in North America, in the Caribbean, in the Mediterranean, elsewhere in Asia, especially against the like of the Mughal Empire. Attempts really two wars against the Mughal Empire, which go about as well as you can expect, and the English are expelled from places like Bengal, which at that point is becoming what, you know, is the up and coming place of trade, not just in Asia but anywhere in the world really. The English kind of essentially defeated and kicked out, and have to go back grovelling years later, and it's rather embarrassing. The island of Bombay is essentially turned into a Mughal naval base, invaded by the Marathas, and it's not gone well. England's just unable to project. There's a naval expedition into the Mediterranean to tackle piracy, the North African corsair states, and again that's humiliated outside the walls of Algiers. It can't even breach the harbour. So kind of weak entity. Now that's been changing at the end of the 17th century. That's reflected in the kind of belligerence of the East India Company elsewhere, who, you know, is challenging. The fact that it's challenging the Mughal Empire suggests a shift in how the English perceive themselves. But essentially, by the turn of the 18th century, the English trade has grown quite considerably. It's the establishment of plantation colonies in the Caribbean, the expansion of settler societies in North America, its control of the trade in enslaved Africans in the Atlantic, and its ability by the turn of the 18th century to peacefully establish trade in places like Bengal and on the Coromandel coast in South India, eventually allowed it to become the leading European trader in Asian goods. So these things, you know, increase the customs, swell the revenues of the English monarchy, enrich investors and merchants, expand shipping and naval resources. And all of this is having a cumulative effect. And it's not just this, but what happens obviously at the beginning of the 18th century is the union between Scotland and England, which creates the political entity of Great Britain. And that stabilizes the state politically. We have the introduction of a degree of religious toleration following the Toleration Act, ends the kind of religious instability that plagued the early English state. And all these things you kind of see, a lot of these continue. You know, there are uprisings against the new union, the monarchy. There's discontent, there's problems. You know, all of these things are ongoing. But generally speaking, the great British state of the early 18th century is a far more capable and effective entity to project itself overseas. So what we just see, you know, just taking one war in the early 18th century, the War of Spanish Succession, you know, Britain is able to finance, a fleet of over 100 warships. It's able to payroll 120,000 troops. It's able to, you know, fight the Spanish and the French and essentially eclipse the Dutch. And so it's just a far more belligerent, that's important to say, but also just a far, far more powerful entity than its English predecessor. And that starts to show elsewhere. So when, you know, these wars do break out in places like India, the sort of 50 years ago, 100 years ago, the East India Company would have had no support from the English state itself. Even in the acquisition of Bombay, which was not an East India Company acquisition, it was the Crown. It was Charles II's part of the dowry of his new Portuguese wife, Catherine of Braganza. He's just unable to afford to secure Bombay and to build it into a colony, and eventually just hands it over to the East India Company. And so that's the kind of role the state plays, very limited. The British state, however, once the East India Company is engaged in conflict in places like Bengal and South India in the early 18th century, it's able to send armadas to the East India Company's aid. You know, the Asian trade has now become a serious kind of tempo of the British economy, not perhaps as much as the trade in the Atlantic, but now it has an effective source of state backing. And the first royal military units appear in the 1740s, the first of a number of Royal Navy fleets, which are almost permanent now in the waters of the Indian Ocean. And this really tips the scales and allows the East India Company to kind of to pursue a far more aggressive and far more political role than it probably had previously. Not to say it didn't previously, it absolutely did, just with less success. I mean, that's on the one hand, but again, that's a rather Eurocentric depiction of the changes of the British Empire. The other one, of course, is that there are massive changes going on elsewhere in the world, which provide the British Empire with more opportunity to kind of fill these vacuums and to expand themselves. So previously in the 17th century, the Mughal Empire was a kind of highly united, very powerful entity. In the 18th century, it's struggling with a series of successor states, the emergence of the Maratha Empire, which is a very powerful new state that's emerging in the heart of the Mughal Empire, the Deccan. The struggle to contain expansive powers in Persia and Afghanistan, all of which raid into North India and sack the capital, Delhi. So you've got whether it's crumbling or not, that's for historians to argue, but you've got the sort of a far more radical political landscape in India, far more fractured, and there's a kind of malleability now to the borders in the way there wasn't. And it provides the East India Company, now better resourced and better supported by the British state, the kind of entryways, the opportunities to intervene and tip local regional conflicts in its favour. And it does that in Bengal from 1757, and eventually within the next 10 years conquers much of eastern India. And by the end of the 18th century, it's pushing its way up the Gangetic Plain. And so there are, so the acts of union are very important. They do, the successor of the English state is this far more powerful state that's capable of a global reach, but there are also fundamental changes happening in the non-European world. So both of those things are important.
Well, then let's make sure we talk about the other side then. When we talk about India, in the book, it makes it like these India company, and yes, even I think when it comes to the British Empire, the East India Company seems to have a somewhat precarious position in India, especially vis-a-vis first the Mughal Empire and then the Maratha Confederacy. How does the East India Company kind of relate to these two Indian powers, kind of on the periphery kind of these powers?
Yeah, I mean, the relationship between the two. I mean, say we're going to take an Indo-centric perspective, which I think we should in the 18th century. There seems quite marginal. They become increasingly important to the Mughal Empire by really from sort of the early 18th century. The import of silver and gold by the Netherlands and by Britain is forming a substantial stream of revenue for the Mughal Empire, which has become, by 1707, with the death of Aurangzeb, probably the most successful in sort of military territorial terms, emperor that sat on the peacock throne. Those sorts of revenue are valuable to help sustain the war effort in the Deccan against the Marathas, to help rebuild shattered Mughal power in the wake of invasions from Central Asia and from Persia. At the end of the 17th century, there's a war between the Eastern Company and the Mughal government in Bengal. It's quite a localized war. But when the Nawab, when the Mughal governor defeats the English, rather than be happy, the emperor is quite annoyed that he's severed this vital stream of income of the import of silver and gold. And it's quite a substantial amount. And so just to give you an example of how important it comes. I mean, so important, by 1717, the Eastern Company are able, you know, only after massive effort and resources, is launching a humongous embassy to Delhi, of miles long train of presents and gifts for the new emperor. They acquire an imperial farm, one that not only kind of consolidates all of the company's commercial privileges and concessions that it enjoys, but eventually abolishes all customs and all taxes on its trade and provides it with even greater benefits, territorial jurisdictional autonomy, increase in its territorial size, and it just really makes it kind of the most competitive commercial entity in India at the time. Indian merchants now are struggling to compete against the East India Company. So I think commercially it's become important, to an extent also militarily, and there's an emphasis by the Mughal emperors and their kind of regional allies to acquire the sort of maritime influence that the English and by the 18th century the British can wield overseas. And the East India Company, one of its kind of obligations is to keep the seas clear of pirates and to help secure the pilgrimage routes to Mecca, especially from the west coast of India, and also in some respects to join in with Mughal military campaigns against its enemy. And there's an example of a number of times when the East India Company has to lend ships to Mughal commanders in their campaigns. It plays out. It's becoming, but it's still relatively marginal on the Mughal kind of political landscape. There's a more decisive change by the second half of the 18th century, especially with the emergence of the Maratha Empire as the real successor to the Mughals. Successor, not in a peaceful sense, but in a military political sense. There's on two levels, the Marathas are hacking the empire apart through military conquests, but also there's an attempt to legitimize themselves within the Mughal system, to acquire the authority and the trappings of Mughal power, and to keep the Mughal edifice to some extent almost like a zombie alive, and work within it whilst almost cannibalizing it from the inside. Those two things are always in tension with one another. But it's clear by sort of the 1770s that the Maratha Empire has done that, and it's much of central, western and north India is now under Maratha rule. There are some and again, for the Marathas, the British are rather marginal. We have to remember that the East India Company conquests in the 18th century are quite quite breathtaking, but they are largely confined to Eastern India. Bengal, especially, the Carnatic to an extent, but that really comes with the 19th century. So if we're looking at it on the 18th century, if we're looking at it from an Indo-centric perspective, the Eastern income is still quite marginal. It's aware, it's playing a more important role. There's also a kind of antagonistic role, not necessarily with the Mughal Empire, to an extent, the conquest of Bengal invited an attempt by the Shazda, the Mughal heir to and Prince Shah Alam, who eventually becomes Shah Alam II, to invade Bengal and dislodge the East India Company. But that ends in the East India Company essentially paying him off and providing him with a tribute and a place at Allahabad as his new capital. But for the Marathas, it's more antagonistic. Essentially, before the English conquest of Bengal, the Marathas had established a kind of tributary relationship over Bengal. Bengal has to pay the Marathas tribute, which was the result of a 10-year war between the Nawab of Bengal, Alivadi Khan, and the Bonslers of Nagpur. And so it kind of, after the British conquest, it still holds the British as tributaries, as they've inherited this chorth, this tax they have to pay to the Maratha emperors. And that triggers conflict with the Marathas. And there's a Maratha army on its way to Bengal to reconquer it. To conquer it for the Maratha Empire and to destroy the East India Company. But that is waylaid at the Battle of Panipat, a very famous battle in 1761 in which the Maratha Empire looks like it's been destroyed by invading Afghan forces. So there is a kind of tradition. Now that explodes. So they're marginal for most of the period. At the very end of the 18th century, that's when the East India Company figure more prominently in the political landscape. There's a series of conflicts. The first Anglo-Maratha War kicks off in 1773, intermittently all the way through to the early 1780s, in which the Marathas eventually prevail over the East India Company. It's not a decisive victory, but the Marathas managed to capture an entire East India Company army. They then build a coalition of Indian states against the East India about the East India Company. We see for the very first time in sources the Marathas appealing to a sense of national identity as a kind of Indians versus these foreigners. And we don't often see that in the sources. In terms of speaking about Indians and Europeans, and it kind of works, and there's this coalition that ends up then destroying an East India Company army in the south with the invasion of Mysore and Tipu Sultan Hyder Ali. And so the East India Company is on the ropes, and finally they throw in the towel and essentially confirms the Marathas as being the hegemonic power in India at the end of the 18th century, not the East India Company. And so I think if we shift our perspective, really for a lot of this period, yeah, the East India Company, despite that, we see this period as the kind of transformative moment of the British in India. Actually, for a lot of people in India, they were still quite a marginal entity.
So I guess to just to wrap things up, you know, what happens after, say, 1800 that moves the British Empire as this kind of precarious set of colonies jockeying for position into the globally dominant entity that we remember today?
Well, I mean, I would argue that it's still is a process that's kind of uncertain. There's a good phrase I always like to refer to in the 19th century as, you know, the British Empire became rampaging, but it also remained somewhat ramshackle. Yes, eventually an empire does emerge, certainly by the turn of the 20th century, that is far more kind of cohesive and united than it had been in the period I'm talking about, the early modern period. And I think that, but we still see this kind of remarkable dynamic of we associate the Victorian period, especially with, this is the period of, you know, European technological superiority, the development of medicine, you know, of steam shipping, the Maxim gun, and we get these series of, you know, there's a series of books, you know, of Victoria's small wars, and we refer to the expansion of the empire in this way as this kind of this modern behemoth against these sort of backward tribes and elsewhere, and yet I see, you know, remarkably similar dynamic happening from the early modern period into the bit really is the zenith of British imperialism, certainly by the later 19th century. And yes, to an extent, there is a kind of substantial increase in power. Obviously, in terms of conquest, there's no question. The territory conquered by the British Empire in the 19th century, you know, is several times over what had been acquired by the earlier English and British Empire in the 17th and 18th century. But we still see these examples of successful resistance to the British Empire, of the resilience of these states and societies that encounter the British Empire. And so, you know, even in our previous course, we left the Indian subcontinent at the end of the 18th century, the Marathas, you know, firmly in control, hegemonic. In the 19th century, that starts to change, but it takes several major conflicts for that to happen. And much of that is due to shifts in the Maratha Empire from being a kind of more centralized empire to becoming a kind of more fragmented confederacy of Maratha states. And that, again, provides the East India Company opportunities to divide those states and to fight them one by one. So, you know, but that is a process that isn't really complete properly until 1815. And some of the most decisive, some of the biggest conflicts that the British Empire fought up until that point. You know, one of them present in one of the Maratha battles is a young Duke of Wellington, Arthur Wellesley, who fights at the Battle of Assaye. And it's an absolutely massive battle. And it's... And he says that's the hardest conflict I've ever seen. We almost lost it. It's a little bit of a kind of forerunner to what he says at Waterloo. So these are kind of substantial conflicts that take place. There's another war in 1803 to 1805, another one in 1814 to 15, and only then is the power of the Maratha Empire broken. But it's the same for the rest of the Indian subcontinent. It really takes another century for the subcontinent to be brought under East India Company control after the Battle of Plassey in 1757, which starts this process. But even then, you know, it faces a massive war. It used to be called the Mutiny. Obviously, we think of it more, I think, accurately now as the War of Independence in 1857, which shakes British power over India to its core, and substantial conflicts in places like the Northwest with the Punjab, several wars to conquer the Punjab, and into Afghanistan, which three wars, generally disastrous, entire British armies are lost in Afghanistan. But it's still not an easy, even if we think of places like West Africa, you know, West Africa had been a site of British interest all the way through since the early 17th century. And then with the establishment of Royal African Company in the 1660s. And in my book, I speak about British attempts to established political influence in West Africa, which are thwarted by the Kingdom of Dahomey, which kind of seizes control of the coast and takes control of the trade in enslaved people. But by the 19th century, there are attempts by the British Empire to take territorial control of West Africa. But it runs up against a series of very powerful West African political entities. The Asante are one of them. You know, the Empire of the Asante is very powerful. They're controlled of vast gold mines in the Akan interior. And it takes the entire 19th century for the British to dismantle Asante hegemony in West Africa. It's not an easy process, and it culminates in a war in the 1890s with the overthrow of the Asante Empire. But the British endure several major defeats, and some of these wars are quite humiliating. At one point, there's one of the earliest wars in 1820s against the Asante. The British march inland, they come under Asante attack, they're dying, and then they order up fresh ammunition, and they open the boxes, and actually it's full of pasta. Some reason accidentally the ammunition boxes have got mixed up with the kitchen boxes, and the English panic to find they have no ammunition, it's just pasta, and are roundly defeated in 1824 by the Asante and said kind of flying back to the coast. So yes, there's a mixture of British stupidity, but also the kind of sheer power and resilience of many of these kingdoms in Africa, which again, we kind of, with the partition of Africa, the scramble for Africa, we see it as kind of a piecemeal, quite easy conquest, but absolutely not. Same in South Africa as well, against the local South African kingdoms there are eight wars that take place across most of this period. It's not an easy thing. It's a process of continual conquest, some quite high profile defeats, you know, even some of the biggest victories of the British Empire. If you're thinking about against the Mahdi in the Sudan, the so-called religious fundamentalists, although I'd argue that the Victorian evangelists of that generation were fundamentalists as well. But, in the Sudan, the English occupation of Egypt leads to its attempt to also subjugate Egypt's own colony of Sudan. The British are roundly defeated by Mahdi religious fundamentalist forces, and they have to abandon Sudan for a good two decades because they're just unable to take it back. And so the Battle of Omdurman in 1897 is, you know, the example of the complete superiority of the West over Africa, with the absolute massacre of Mahdist troops in the face of Maxim or machine guns. So yes, there are those examples, but that really is at the end of 25 years of being essentially ejected from Sudan and being defeated on several occasions. So yes, the British do bring massive power to bear on the non-European world in the 19th century. They've assembled, as we often say, the largest empire at that point in human history, but it's not one that's won easily, and it's not one free of failure and defeat. And there are stories of significant non-European resilience and resistance in the face of that kind of overwhelming power of the British Empire.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with David Vevers, author of The Great Defiance, How the World Took on the British Empire. David, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? Not just this book, but all of your work. And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
I think, thanks for those questions. I'll start with the second one first. I'm doing a much smaller history next. This is the book I've always wanted to write, and it's a 300 year history across four continents. It's a big, chronologically and thematically big book, and I'm so pleased I've written it. So for the next, but I don't think I've got it in me to do something similar straight away anyway, and I very much like to continue this kind of story in the way I've discussed with you into the 19th and 20th centuries, but for now I've zoomed all the way down, and I'm looking at a slightly, I guess we could call it, a micro history a far more smaller, intimate story, still with the theme of colonialism, but looking at a specific story set within the Caribbean in the 17th century. It's a really fascinating story, but it's nice to go back to the kind of small scale, kind of almost claustrophobic story that I'm telling of just a few individuals over a 10 or 20 year period rather than 300. So that's something I'm just working on now. That will kind of consume me, I think, for the next sort of 3 or 4 years, which is nice. Where can people find my work? Well, this is my second book, really. My first book was with Cambridge University Press, which was, I'm a South Asianist by training, and my first book is The Origins of the British Empire in Asia, 1600 to 1750, and looking at the expansion of the East India Company, like this book, not as a projection of itself or not at the expense of existing powers within Asia, but rather the East India Company's journey into kind of integrating itself in a kind of more suppliant, subordinate way into very powerful, resilient structures of economic and political power. So learning to use diplomacy, learning to acquire cultural and political capital and influence, working with Indian partners to establish themselves in forts and establish their trade. That's with Cambridge University Press. Between then and there, I've got various articles in various places that people will find on those themes of the company's expansion, of the British Empire, focusing on indigenous culture as well. So I've done a lot of work on the Malay on the west coast of Sumatra, the Minangkabau of the island of Sumatra. It's a very fascinating kind of matriarchal society, but it's also one of the premier pepper growing cultures in Southeast Asia, and look at that kind of interaction between Minangkabau society the encroaching European presence on the coast and how that operates. So it's predominantly been academic. This is my first kind of public history, first kind of trade book, and so my next one will hopefully be as well something people can find widely in all good bookshops.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRiGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all of your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends, support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Gwyn Wally, translator of Eight Dogs or Hakenden, Part 2, His Master's Blade. But before then, David, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.